This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Into the 7 o'clock hour we go. Payne and Pendergast with you. Sports Radio 610. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne. And Seth, so Rusty Harden files a reply yesterday to the 22 plaintiffs. There's about two-thirds of them mentioned by name in the reply. So I think it's fair to wonder where the other third kind of sit in terms of Rusty Harden and his team being able to do investigations on them and so forth. But Rusty Harden, in a subsequent statement that he put out after the filing, says in no uncertain terms that he feels and Watson's camp feels that the allegations of sexual misconduct against Deshaun Watson are lies. A resounding yes, he says, to the question of whether or not the 22 plaintiffs are lying about their allegations of sexual misconduct by Deshaun Watson. So we'll see what happens now over the next few days. Tony Busby, on behalf of the 22 plaintiffs, appears to still be dug in and ready to go fight Rusty Harden's contentions. I think the most interesting thing probably over the next couple days will be, are there still 22 plaintiffs today, tomorrow,
right,
the next
right.
day? What happens now?
Right, because so Harden mentioned 14 women by name in terms of actual allegations that they either lied or that there are inconsistencies in their statements and their lawsuits. There's two more women that he mentions as having scrubbed their social media accounts. But that still leaves, you know, from the 14 that he's claiming, or at least he mentioned their names as actually lying, that leaves eight other women potentially that they either haven't found information on or they didn't want to divulge their names, whatever it might be. But yeah, you wonder with 14 of these women, if he has a case for some of them that maybe they were untruthful, do some of them start dropping? And I mean, hypothetically, if 11 women drop the lawsuits out of a total 22 sometime in the next 2 days, does that embolden some of the other teams around the league to say, all right, well, look, you know what? Maybe we take a chance and we still get Deshaun at a bargain, but it looks like a lot of what his defense attorney has been saying might have some merit to it.
I think you pointed out the key part of everything you just said there was the word bargain. That's the key with all of this from both the Texans' perspective and any potential trade suitor with Deshaun Watson, because I think still, Seth, even if half of the 22 women pulled out of their lawsuits, A, you still got 11 that are left over. B, you still got the NFL investigating this thing, so there's a suspension in all likelihood sitting out there. C, there is still the element of criminal complaints against Deshaun Watson right now that have not been resolved yet. So at any phone call that comes to the Texans, that the removal of some of these plaintiffs from the equation would get a team to make these phone calls, are probably going to be discounted offers that the Texans are getting. And I think depending on what the offer is, the Texans would have to think about it. But I'm somebody who would, if you're telling me, would I rather take a discounted offer for Deshaun Watson right now and just be done with it or wait it out? I would rather wait it out, because I think what that would show is that things are starting to trend in the right direction for Deshaun Watson, and that I would rather trade a fully, or at least as close to fully cleansed Deshaun Watson by next year, as opposed to trading him as a distressed asset this year.
This is where I think sometimes when I hear attorneys talk about this case, sometimes the attorneys forget that there are really two separate things going on here. One is there's the strictly legal matter, but then there's, on the other side, there's a very real PR concern by Deshaun's camp above and beyond the actual allegations. You know, how it affects him materially. When you start talking about settlement amounts and everything, you kind of got to factor into all the accounting how much another team's going to be willing to pay in the future, how much he might lose on his contract, how much endorsements he'll lose, all that stuff. And I think from a PR front, yesterday was a victory for Harden on a PR front, for Rusty Harden and Deshaun Watson, because of this. Let's say they settle now with a certain, let's say especially if several of these women drop out. We still have eight names we haven't seen mentioned at all. And we have no idea what Harden's argument is about those women, you know, that he didn't mention by name. Or excuse me, we've got six we haven't seen at all. Eight total where he hasn't accused them of lying outright. Right. So with those women, if a bunch of lawsuits were to drop, but then Deshaun were to settle with everybody else, what Harden has done now is he's gotten his allegations out in the media. And I think a large portion of the public at that point, it's a lot easier for them to say, oh, well, look at that. Remember, all those women were lying and Deshaun ended up settling just to get moved past it. And that's how people remember it, yeah. Especially in other NFL cities where this story really hasn't been covered with nearly the intensity that it has in Houston. It's every now and then it's on the ESPN front page headlines, but really not all that much about it, just kind of a brief appraisal of where the status of the trial is. So I think that if all these were settled out of court, I think on the PR side of things, other teams aren't going to have to worry about it nearly as much as perhaps it feels like they would here in Houston.
I think the other thing he can use on the PR front, Seth, Deshaun Watson, is his trade demands. Is his want to get up and out of Houston and say that, you know, look, a big reason I settled this is because a trial was going to take 18 months, two years.
Yeah.
You know, I needed to move on professionally, and so I just started to look at it as a transaction as opposed to any sort of admission of guilt. It was just, you know, broken glass and a necessary cost for me to move on from all this ugliness so that I could move on in my professional career as well.
Now, that strategy can blow up in your face. Like with Roberto Osuna, his agent claims that the reason they settled so quickly was because they could see the writing on the wall and they just wanted to get through it as quickly as possible. That there was probably, if there was going to be a chance of a suspension, just do it now and get it done and over with. People don't always buy that explanation, you know, and each case is different. So now, and Roberto Osuna, to be clear, was domestic violence, not similar circumstances, Deshaun, different cases, but still, you know, violence or crimes against women. So I don't know. You brought this point up, Sean. The criminal ones are the ones that probably carry the most weight in the mind of the public.
Sure.
You know, do the police press continue with the case? Does a district attorney want to press charges? Yeah. If so, I don't think any amount of settlement in the lawsuits is going to rectify the PR damage to those criminal things.
I think if you're Deshaun and if you're the Texans and you're looking at this purely from a football standpoint, we preface all this by saying we understand there's a human element to this. We're looking at it in this segment strictly from a football transactional standpoint. Seth, what would move the needle more for teams looking to potentially trade for Deshaun Watson if half the lawsuits fell out but he still had criminal investigation going on, or all 22 plaintiffs are staying in this thing, but the police came out and said, we don't find enough here to prosecute Deshaun Watson?
I think in that second instance, like, people are pretty aware now and understand that it's a lot harder to prove it in a criminal court or to get a conviction in a criminal court. As opposed to 22 women in a civil case is still a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Boy, those are still – neither of those put – Deshaun in all that rosy of a position. But I think settling all of the, in a weird way, settling all of the civils but still having the criminal investigations might be less scary to the cops, because I think they would, or to other teams, because I think they would assume that if the women are dropping the civil allegations, that they're probably not going to be all that strong of a witness or have a strong case in the criminal side, and it's just a matter of the criminal investigation taking a while.
That's a game of guts poker right there. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, as long as there's a criminal investigation, there remains a non-zero chance Deshaun Watson could do jail time. I don't think, you know, I think that's probably the underdog in this whole thing, but it still sits out there.
It's just such a strange, unique situation to where, because there are 22 lawsuits,
yeah,
not to mention 24 total women, one that spoke to Sports Illustrated, one that dropped the lawsuit. So 24 women have come forward to some degree with stories to the point where you, in your mind, even though it doesn't make logical sense, somehow it seems like allegations of four would just be like, oh, wow, that's not much at all. Like, right. No, four under normal circumstances, that's a whole lot of allegations under normal circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, 713-572-4610. That's the number to text or call the show today. Sean Pendergast and Seth Payne with you on a Tuesday. Amy Dash is going to join us in about 50 minutes. She is a legal expert. As you know, she's joined us throughout this whole saga, and she will help make sense of the filing that Rusty Harden had yesterday on behalf of Deshaun Watson, a reply filing to the allegations of the 22 plaintiffs in this case. All right, sticking with Deshaun Watson, the one part of the Deshaun Watson reply filed yesterday that I think common sense tells me, I think Busby can easily punch holes in. We'll tell you what that is next. All right, so Rusty Harden filed the reply to the allegations, the 22 plaintiffs, an official court document, filed it yesterday, issued a statement following that where he says that that they believe, they being Harden and Watson's camp, that all 22 plaintiffs are lying about alleged sexual misconduct by Deshaun Watson. Tony Busby fired back with a statement of his own, and obviously contradicting what Rusty Harden is saying. You know, they're continuing to say that Deshaun Watson did engage in these acts. He can't deny that he sought out an unusually high number of women for massages on Instagram and that he was being nude or nearly nude in these sessions. He says, of course, that Deshaun Watson claims that these were consent. The sexual acts were consensual. Tony Busby says they were not consensual. So here we sit. And I guess we should point this out, Seth. We have not mentioned this. The next legal proceeding in this is set to take place on Thursday this week. So there is a hearing. There is a hearing scheduled for Thursday this week, so that'll be the next time that these parties are together, either in person or virtually in a courtroom with one another.
This is the one where, too, and I guess this might be a question for when we have Amy Dash, our legal expert, on later, is, you know, Busby has chosen to, you know, try to treat all these cases as one as much as possible, and he's probably trying to establish a pattern of behavior. But now if you get to a point where if let's say – let's say hypothetically that at least a bunch of these allegations that Harden made yesterday are true, and that many of these plaintiffs have been caught in a lie, or, you know, basically either bragged about it afterwards, scheduled more sessions than they had admitted to or said they did afterwards. And that's, I think that's one of the big factual errors that perhaps some of the women made allegedly that would be pretty damning. At what point then does Busby have to start backpedaling and say, well, okay, well, no, that's that person. This person's different. Is he going to have to start kind of doing triage on the cases and figure out which ones are stronger and which ones are weaker? But meanwhile, you've been treating them all almost like they're all one big case.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you illustrate a scenario there where the sheer volume of the cases come back to bite him a little bit. I'll say this. There's a lot of things that Rusty Harden alleges in here with various quantities of the plaintiffs in terms of they're offering to work for Deshaun Watson, again, even after the alleged incidents, lying about the number of sessions they actually had with Deshaun Watson. There are several different categories of either mistruth or blurred lines that the plaintiffs have allegedly put out there, according to Harden. I think of all of them, Seth, the one in reading through all of these, you know, there's... You read through all of them and you go, okay, I think Tony Busby can poke holes in that. I think Tony Busby's going to have a tough time with that one. I mean, we're playing amateur lawyer here on the air. I do think the one, and this is purely from a human standpoint, that Tony Busby, to me, the one he's going to have the easiest time poking holes in is part D. Plaintiffs lied about their alleged trauma and resulting harm. It's always difficult when you climb inside the brain of somebody and say, this is how they were feeling when they were doing something. And it feels like that's what Rusty Harden is trying to do here. I'll read the first one as an example. This is the most poignant one because this is the one plaintiff that we've all seen in public, in person, at a press conference, talking about the trauma that she suffered, allegedly, in the session with Deshaun Watson. And it's plaintiff number one, Ashley Solis. Rusty Harden says in his reply, Ashley Solis claimed during a news conference that she, quote, can no longer practice the profession that she loves the most without shaking during a session. Yet, publicly available information shows that she's provided multiple massages after the alleged incident with Mr. Watson. Indeed, not only is she still accepting clients, but according to those who have worked with her, she did not show any signs of trauma during these sessions. That one feels a little over the top to me, to the point where not only are you climbing inside the brain of a plaintiff to say, no, she's not experiencing trauma because she continued to work. I would point out that a lot of these people probably need to continue to work in order to pay their bills, no?
Right, yeah, and that's where attorneys are so frustrating sometimes because both Busby and Harden have done this at times where they'll say stuff that they don't need to say, and it weakens the rest of them in your mind because these are the things that you know about or that things that very easily are just like you're making a statement that could easily be false. Like, those are the things that are easy to figure out. Well, what don't I know about these other witnesses or what have you on both sides that you're claiming? And I think that, okay, so Ashley Solis said that she couldn't work on clients without shaking, but that's not something that's necessarily immediately apparent to somebody who's face down on a massage table,
right?
Or who's working or who's laying there with their eyes closed or what have you. Doesn't say anything about what did Rusty Harden speak to every client that Ashley Solis has worked with. I'm guessing that maybe it's different with women than it is with men. All of that. And then the other thing Harden said in this statement, and Harden did make some good points. If it fleshes out, some of these allegations made by Harden would be very damning to some of these plaintiffs. I'm trying to tell it equal here. But there's one thing that I've heard from Harden a couple times now that's just logically wrong. This is where Harden says this. Ashley Solis claimed she was not filing suit for monetary reasons. Okay, and then he goes on to say, like, well, she already showed that she was filing for monetary reasons. To be very clear,
she was seeking a settlement.
That she was seeking a settlement. Yeah. She never, in her statement that she made sitting next to Busby, and Harden referenced the press conference, she said it's not just about the money.
Right.
So implied in that is that, yeah, it is partially about the money. Mm-hmm. We're asking for a reward. That's what you do in civil court. So I get kind of offended when he's very clearly there twisting something she said,
yeah,
and claiming she said something that she did not. So, okay, don't do that. Like, you've got a very strong case with a lot of these other allegations you've just made, but here you are just flat out misrepresenting something that she said and I saw with my own eyes on my computer. So it makes me wonder exactly how much or how strong the rest of the evidence he presented yesterday is.
Yeah, here's another one from Section D. Again, Section D says Rusty Harden claims plaintiffs lied about their alleged trauma and resulting harm. The second one, we just went through Ashley Solis. The second one, plaintiff Toy Garner claims that, quote, by the end of the massage, she was sweating and, quote, there was nowhere for her to go. She neglects to mention she had multiple family members in the home and nearby during both therapy sessions. And I would say that there's no, just because there were family members in the home doesn't mean that she didn't feel some sort of trauma and anxiety in that massage session.
Yeah, I guess that's the part. So again, you're right. The whole part where he second guesses or questions how a woman was actually feeling in the alleged situation.
Yes.
That's where he has to tread very carefully.
Yeah.
And that's where I think is a little bit of a misstep here. He brought up a whole lot of really intriguing points yesterday that sheds doubt on some of what the plaintiff said. But this is the one where it sounds a whole lot like a guy saying, like, ah, whatever, she ain't that scared, you know, like, ah, what, it comes off as a little bit tone deaf to the differences between the way men and women respond to things, what a situation is like, how scary it can be, all of that. And he didn't need to do it because the actual alleged facts that he's bringing up, hey, this woman said that she couldn't work with Deshaun again, but then she worked three more times with Deshaun. That kind of stuff, that's something that you can verify.
Yes.
You can look at. It's not a report of a feeling.
Yeah, for example, plaintiff Marshall Davis, who shows up in some of the other sections in this reply set that you're referring to that are much stronger, seemingly, legally, and a lot less, I guess, offensive maybe. She's included in this section as well, where they're climbing inside the brains of the plaintiff saying, well, they lied about their trauma. Marshall Davis alleges that, quote, she was alone at the spa and feared for her life during her therapy sessions with Mr. Watson. However, a security guard hired by the spa was present at the spa at all times and capable of intervening if an incident had in fact occurred. That doesn't mean, because there's a security guard, doesn't mean that she wasn't experiencing trauma, fear, and anxiety. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It is a slippery slope is the best way to put it. You put it best.
I shouldn't be afraid of sticking my hand in this garbage disposal because there's a hospital two blocks down the street.
Kind of, that's what it is. Yeah, and I'm with you. I just felt like I read, and those are the only three plaintiffs that show up in that section. But that to me, especially because it's section D and it comes after three sections, which are pretty strong. You read those first three and you're like, this is some pretty compelling stuff on behalf of Deshaun, and you get to that when you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, my thought through most of it was, okay, and I was kind of monitoring for this. At any point here, as I was reading through some of the allegations that Harden was making about the plaintiffs, all right, is he venturing into potentially bullying the alleged victims or slut-shaming them or talking about promiscuity in the past or anything? For the most part, every step along the way, he was strictly bringing up things that were relevant and unique to this case.
Yep.
Like, so he was talking. So I don't think they ventured into looking like they were just shaming people or trying to smear the names of the plaintiffs other than for things that were very relevant to this case until you get to that part. That's where it felt like old school, like, women complain too much. Not taking a woman's complaint seriously.
Yeah, I think Busby's going to feast on that part if indeed it comes to that. If these ever wind up in a courtroom, both sides, both lawyers are saying right now that they're welcoming that. Settlement still appears to be very much in play for all this. All right. We're going to do some headlines. We're going to talk to Amy Dash about all this in about a half hour. This story about the Super League over in European soccer, I'm not a huge European soccer guy, but I'm fascinated by 12 and soon to be 15 prominent European soccer clubs breaking away and forming their own Super League. What would that look like over here with our sports? And man, what kind of earth-shaking sports earthquake would we have if there were an NFL Super League? That's next. This story out of European soccer. We don't talk a lot of European soccer on the show. I got to talk to my buddy Wallace about this today.
Sean.
What?
I'm sure we're going to get 12 texts from snooty soccer fans. We're like, you know, in the rest of the world, football is soccer.
Yeah.
That's what football is actually soccer.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. I didn't learn that when I was like 6 years old, but thanks for informing me now. You're so urbane. You're so sophisticated.
So 12 of Europe's top football clubs announced on Sunday they were launching a breakaway Super League headed by Real Madrid president Florentino Perez. I'm not going to list all the teams, but there's some big names in there. You don't need to be a European soccer fan to know Liverpool and Manchester City and Manchester United, Real Madrid, Chelsea, Barcelona, 12 teams from across Europe, and there's going to be three more added. There's actually going to be three more added, so there will be 15 teams total that will never get relegated out of the Super League. It's going to be a 20-team league where five of the spots will get kind of cycled through. Obviously, there's still a lot of moving parts. And Seth, the reaction to this across the soccer universe has been almost universal scorn at these 12 teams for moving on in what appears to be largely a media rights-driven thing. There's billions of dollars in TV revenue that TV networks are ready to pay to watch all these teams play in a Super League with one another.
The Glazer family, you know, the Bucks owners, they own, what do they own? Manchester United?
One of the Manchesters, yeah.
So apparently these soccer teams are a big deal in England, Sean.
Is that your take from all this?
That's my take, yeah. Apparently it's a big deal. And how many English Premier League teams are leaving? Is it six that are leaving the Premier League. There's 14 remaining Premier League clubs will hold an emergency meeting on Tuesday, but the six Super League sides are not invited.
Yes.
So I don't know if there's – I can't tell from that sentence whether there's 14 or 20 total.
There's 20 total.
Premier League teams. There's 20
total in the Premier League. So six, and you know, presumably the six most prominent brands or six of the most prominent brands – are moving on to this Super League. So there's emergency meetings going on right now. There's fans that are irate that these 12 teams have basically just dropped a gigantic nuclear bomb in the middle of soccer because it's affecting three different huge European leagues over there. It's not just the Premier League.
Chaos. I've been enjoying with no dog in the fight. I've been enjoying watching English Premier League, which frankly has annoyed me on social media for years now. Is various people with fewer children than me just have a glorious time. Hey, let's go get drunk on a Saturday morning and wear a silly jersey and pretend I'm a Brit for a day. Yeah, I would that being relegated to minor league status. I think it's awesome. I think the shambles of the English Premier League and what remain of it will be a warning shot to England forever. Is this just one more in the long, slow decline of the British Empire and all of the fact that they're clinging on to their monarchy? This is all punishment for that. So enjoy the slow and steady degradation that's been going on for a couple of centuries.
Okay,
now.
So 12 teams are forming a Super League in Europe, and your two big takeaways are you still hold a grudge about taxation without representation from the 1700s, and you're angry at hipsters here now today that root for Premier League teams.
Yeah.
Those are your two big takes on this.
Sheer jealousy and animosity. Jealousy over the hipsters and lingering animosity from the damn monarchy. Yep.
Taxation without representation. Yeah. So this is a big deal. And Seth, of course, you get the
whiskey tax. That's what did it. Oh no, no wait, that was when we were already the U.S.
Yeah, that was amongst ourselves, right? This in reading about this, Seth, you know what this felt a lot like? College football realignment. Just in reading about it, you know, like all the big brands are consolidating and stealing teams from other leagues so they can go get billions of dollars in TV money. I'm like, oh, we do this over here. It's called Power Five College Football, where conferences are raiding other conferences for their teams. It's certain conferences. I mean, hell, the Big East basically just disappeared into dandelion spores because the ACC Ooh. And the Big Ten and,
you know,
and the Big 12 raided their coffers.
Yeah, maybe the Big East is the best example of, well, let's see, which conference has been basically relegated to the minor leagues the most or the worst?
I think the five Power Five conferences have all managed to stay above the fray. You know, the ACC, the SEC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, and the Pac-12 have all managed to, you know, stay solvent and make a lot of money. They're getting a lot of, you know, some more than others, but getting a lot of TV money. The conference that I think is viewed as the one that's been the most screwed over in all this is the American Athletic Conference that University of Houston is a part of, because it's basically a combination of all the leftovers from all the conferences that got raided, you know?
Yeah.
It's all the refugees.
Yeah, if you were once in the Southwest Conference and now you're just in the – yeah, that's probably the best thing. The Big East hung on for a little bit, right, with football as people were starting to leave. Did you hear that? I did a right again, Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, Casario is in my brain now.
But I'm not noticing it that much. I think you're doing it in a way where you're not using it as a verbal crutch. You're actually – you're literally checking in there, so don't worry about it. You sound fine.
I'll try to keep it down to maybe like four per hour.
Right.
So, yeah, so the AAC is, you're right, that's probably the best. So is this going to turn the English Premier League into the AAC?
Right.
Or the Big East, well, it will still struggling hanging on. And my guess would be probably.
Yeah, because you're not going to be able to demand the TV dollars. That's the big difference between the haves and the have-nots in college football. We have a lot of people pointing out on the text page after I tease this that, hey, guys, you know, this is, Sean, we're about to have what they're doing in European soccer. We're about to have that in college football when the five Power Five conferences break away from the NCAA to form their own Super League. Here's what I would point out. Look, if the five Power Five conferences break away, they've already kind of started to do that because the difference in the TV money is so drastic from those five conferences, which are 65 teams total versus the rest of college football. What this would be, the equivalent in college football, would be if the 15 best teams in college football, regardless of conference, decided to go break away and form their own deal. Not the Power Five conferences, Seth, but I believe it's Pete Thamel who did this piece for The Athletic Andy Staples did this piece for The Athletic. He said this would be the equivalent of not just the Power Five, those 65 schools breaking away and forming their own thing. This would be the equivalent of Alabama, Auburn, Clemson, Florida, Georgia, LSU, Michigan. He threw Nebraska in there because of their name. Notre Dame, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Oregon, Penn State, UT, and USC. Those 15 schools, that would be the equivalent of them breaking away. So can you imagine Aggies who would sit there and who moved to the SEC for greener pastures? It's been a great, certainly fiscally, it's been ideal for the Aggies. Can you imagine if the Aggies all of a sudden were sitting on the outside looking in of a super league that included the University of Texas?
Right, and I think that the difference in Europe especially is, hey, look, if you want to go watch teams play in the SEC or the Big 12, yes, there are some that are geographically easy to get to, but some are going to be quite a haul in an airplane ride, most likely, or a long RV trip. Like the English Premier League, you know, that's such a tiny nation. You got all those historical rivalries right there. Mm-hmm. I do, and like all joking aside, I would feel bad for English Premier League fans, especially the ones left on the outside, because you've got historical rivalries that are intense as hell to the point where young people beat each other with pipes in the streets over it. That's my perception of English Premier League. A whole bunch of limeys beating each other's brains with pipes in the streets.
Right.
Yeah, the hooligans and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But that's all just going to be kind of dashed against the rocks. And you're going to be – and then the psychological effect of knowing, you are definitely totally you're a B league now.
Right.
You are all the best talent is ultimately going to end up in this super league because that's where the most TV money is going to be. I'm sure. I wonder for soccer purists, is it pretty intriguing? I'd have to think. Right. You're going to have more. You're going to have a bigger assemblage of more really good players from week to week, all playing against each other. But then it is also going to take – I mean, some of these teams, look, in every league, some of these powerhouses are going to be – in any given year, they're going to be bad. Like, one of these teams will end up as the Browns.
Yeah.
You know, before these last couple years. One of these teams is going to end up as the Bengals.
Yep.
Like, they will turn into the bastard stepchildren of the league.
It's a zero-sum game. Like, you know, you take these 12 teams, or ultimately it's 20 teams – and half of them have to lose every weekend. You know what I mean? So you're absolutely right, Seth. What would a 12 team breakaway from the NFL look like? If a bunch of TV companies, if the NFL all of a sudden wasn't 32 teams acting in concert with one another, in solidarity with one another, revenue sharing and everything, and 12 teams decided to break away from the NFL, which teams would the TV networks come after to form an NFL Super League, do you think?
Well, I think you start off with the NFC East immediately because despite the fact that they don't have a single competitive football team, they bring in a whole lot of revenue.
Yes. I think at least three of those teams would be in the Super League.
Well, in 2019, the Cowboys brought in the most revenue in the NFL.
Yeah.
The Washington football team was fifth. This sort of shows you it's not a true meritocracy. The Eagles were seventh in total revenue. And the Giants
gotta have a New York team in there though.
Yeah, you got it. Oh no, the Giants were third most revenue. This is what's going to surprise people.
Hmm.
This is what's going to make people outside the state of Texas wonder. Hey, wait a second. How did that team make the NFL Super League? Houston Texans, fourth most revenue. So I say you slap the Texans in there. I'm going, Sean, since this is a money grab after all, I'm just going to go with the top 12 revenue teams, which is going to...
Okay, who are they? Let's hear
it. It's going to bring you luminaries. It's going to bring you a powerhouse league that includes the Houston Texans, the Atlanta Falcons, the Chicago Bears, the Miami Dolphins, all these teams. You can't the Steelers, the lowly losers that there are like halfway down. They're like 15th in the league.
Can you imagine?
But I might throw them in there anyway.
Can you imagine a super league that doesn't include the Steelers or the Packers?
Here would be the top 12 just based on 2019 revenue. Okay. This can obviously change from year to year. The Cowboys, the Patriots, the Giants, that all makes sense.
Yeah.
The Texans, the Washington football team, the San Francisco 49ers.
Okay.
The Texans are a surprise there. The Washington football team, it just always they get a ton of people. It doesn't matter how good or bad they are.
Got about 9 teams that should be a lock for this, just culturally and brand wise. Go ahead.
So 7 through 12 on the top highest producing revenue teams in 2019. The Eagles.
Yep.
The Jets,
yep.
The Falcons, the Packers. Packers make sense.
Okay.
Bears make sense.
Yep.
Broncos make sense.
Yep.
They pull a lot. And then the Dolphins, which makes no sense at all. Crappy sports state and a crappy sports team, and yet they were 12th in total revenue in 2019.
So this would be a league that would not include the – if we just went by top 12 revenue, the Super League would be a league where the Steelers would be left behind, the Kansas City Chiefs would be left behind. The Green Bay Packers made the cut, so those are the Houston Texans would be in there. Can you imagine the Texans being in a Super League and the Pittsburgh Steelers not being in or the Chiefs not being in a Super League?
You know, I don't know if I can trust this league because they transposed two of these. The Saints and the Seahawks both should have been ahead of the Dolphins. And the Seahawks were above the Saints. So the Seahawks would actually be in that league instead of the Dolphins.
Okay, there you go.
So who's on there that should have been in it that wasn't? Like, I would say the Rams should probably be there because they're your marquee. The NFL wanted so desperately to have a team in L.A. forever that the Rams make sense.
Yep. Yeah, I think of the 12 teams you name that are there, like the teams where I circle and I go, just from a branding standpoint, probably don't belong in a 12-team Super League, probably the Houston Texans. I would say the Atlanta Falcons. I would say the Philadelphia Eagles are on the fence. And the Jets. But the Jets are in New York, so you know, you never know.
I almost feel like any of those old blue blood franchises from either the NFC North or the NFC East, I feel like they've got it. If you're going to have an NFL Super League, except for the Lions would be the one. The Lions are like the black sheep of a very wealthy family that gets cast out and gets cut out of the trust.
They're the Tottenham Hotspur of this situation.
Oh,
that's the one
Tottenham.
That's the one thing I've learned in reading the article, Seth, is that I read an article in The Ringer. I read one in The Athletic. Apparently, Tottenham Hotspur is the one team out of these 12 that's like the black sheep. They're like, huh, how did these losers get in here? But
a bunch of wankers, the Tottenham Hotspurs.
That's right. But
what I would call them if I were English.
They are wankers. Absolutely.
Am I allowed to say that?
You just did.
Okay,
yeah,
I don't
twice.
Even know.
And
what,
I followed up and said it. Yeah. All right. Let's. Let's
tossers, bunch of slags. Yeah, they've lost the plot. They have the daft cows, the Tottenham Spurs.
Let's do
the barmy SOBs.
Let's do headlines. Amy Dash, top of the hour. All right, first headline. We've talked about it a lot this morning. We'll talk about it some more with Amy Dash, so we won't dig too deep right here. But Deshaun Watson's camp has fired back in a reply filing yesterday. 7 pages, and Rusty Harden comes up with several statistics of different plaintiffs, different groups of plaintiffs that bragged about being massaging Deshaun Watson, excited about it. Plaintiffs that offered to work for Deshaun Watson again, even after alleged incidents. Plaintiffs that lied about the number of sessions. Basically, several different categories of plaintiffs that, in trying to cast doubt on the 22 cases that have been filed against Deshaun Watson, will sum up like this, because Rusty Harden put out a statement to the media following the filing. The answer to the question of whether we are saying that all 22 plaintiffs are lying about the allegations of sexual misconduct by Mr. Watson is a resounding yes. So, Seth, even though there are only 14 that are mentioned by name in here that fall into the categories of either mistruth or blurred lines with Deshaun Watson, there are still 8 plaintiffs remaining where there is no story for them right now in this. However, Rusty Harden in his statement says all 22 of these are lying about Deshaun Watson.
Yeah. So that's where I guess the first time where a defense attorney in situations like these has to walk a fine line where you're not, you're basically you're accusing people of lying without calling them liars. And, you know, because you have to say, listen, we take all complaints seriously. You can't, you can't defile these women's good names or what have you. And yet, at the same time, we don't believe anything. This was the most aggressive stance they've taken. And I think he made some, good points that if some of these alleged things that Harden is claiming are true, then they deal a pretty hefty blow to some of the plaintiffs. 14 women were named as having either lied or given statements that were inconsistent with other facts. Like, so 14 of them looked like if these allegations are true by Harden, it's kind of a big deal. Two other names in there were just women that he had said had scrubbed their social media accounts or altered them somehow.
Or deleted them altogether.
Right, right. So I don't know. I know that's an issue if you're going into a legal matter. As far as whether they're telling the truth or not, I don't know. Like, there's other reasons that they would scrub their social media accounts, including the fact that when you accuse a public person of sexual abuse, you tend to get a whole lot of abuse on your social media.
Right.
So I would say 14 of the women have allegations against them now by Harden that would be pretty harmful to their case. We haven't seen the names of the other eight. So that's where what the inconsistencies might have been. So I don't know if that's forthcoming. They have only had the names for about a week or so now.
Yeah.
So I they've been doing a whole lot of research, pretty intense research.
Boy, have they ever. I mean, if we're taking the filing just at face value, they've talked to family members, they've talked to security guards, they've talked to people who are close to these massage therapists. They have the legwork that has been put in by Rusty Harden and his team is fairly remarkable. Tony Busby replied in a statement yesterday to the press that Deshaun Watson's only defense is to call these brave women liars. The weak and vague allegations made in defendant's response are demonstrably false. Goes on to point out all the falsehoods that he alleges and the plaintiffs allege are in Deshaun Watson's account of what went on in those massages. Next item on the calendar is a Thursday hearing between the two sides. So we look to Thursday now for the next, well, the next action item. As we know with this case, things could pop up this afternoon that all of a sudden are breaking news. We'll talk about it more with Amy Dash in just a few minutes.
And I think the thing to watch now is we'll probably get a pretty good feel for maybe how true some of Harden's allegations are, or I guess how solid they are, because it's all like, I'm not accusing Harden of being a liar, but I am saying that everything gets presented by the attorney in the most convincing way possible. Will some of the plaintiffs drop their cases now? Do we see a few plaintiffs drop? If so, I would think, okay, well, at least in those instances, then Harden's got something here.
Yeah, when I say yes, I'm agreeing. Just to be clear, I'm not answering Seth's question, will plaintiffs drop the cases? I'm agreeing with Seth that is the next question. I don't want to sit here going, oh, yes, of course they're going to drop their cases. We'll ask Amy Dash that at the top of the hour. She's our legal expert. All right, next headline. The Astros are back in action. They had another off day yesterday. Boy, they have been peppered with off days at the beginning of the year. They are, Seth, getting a bunch of guys back. To me, the bigger news maybe is who's not returning than who is returning, although getting Alex Bregman, Yordan Alvarez, and your starting catcher Martin Maldonado back is that's not small potatoes there. Do we know what's up with Jose Altuve, though? Jose Altuve is not returning to the team right now.
I'm guessing because we've gotten very little information about any of this. The only thing we know so far is that one of the guys who wasn't on this list definitely was having issues from the COVID vaccine, and that's Lance McCullers.
Right.
As far as the actual guys who are out because of some COVID situation, we don't know. But that if you do test positive for COVID, you're going to be gone for at least 10 days. So maybe Altuve tested positive for – that's just completely me asking a question. Maybe Altuve tested positive. The other guys were just close contact issues.
Yeah, so they're in Colorado tonight to take on the Rockies. Lance McCullers, you mentioned his name, Seth. He will miss his start because of the symptoms that you're talking about. COVID vaccine is not treating him real, real well the last several days. Pitching at altitude with COVID symptoms from the vaccine, probably not ideal. So I believe it's a Luis Garcia joint tonight and a Jose Urquidy joint tomorrow.
Hmm.
Garcia pitched well his last time out in relief. He pitched, I want to say, like four innings of shutout relief. So we'll see. You know, Colorado is a place where pitchers go to die sometimes.
The pitching, generally, I think the pitching is it's a little bit of a concern, Sean.
It's hit or miss.
The hitting. I feel the hitting is going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. You know, the Astros are actually sixth in team OPS right now.
Okay.
And obviously you've been losing.
It does not feel like it.
I know it doesn't
at
feel
all.
Like it. But three of your best hitters will be coming back here over the next few games, yeah. And beyond that, it's just you've only played 11% of the season. And baseball people keep saying that, and that feels like a lot. Like, when you say, like, hey, it's only 11% of the season, like, yeah, 1 out of 10 is – like, if I'm running wind sprints, like, I feel like after the first one, I only got 9 left. That's something, yeah.
Next headline, as we're a few minutes away from talking to Amy Dash about the Deshaun Watson case here at the top of the hour. Alex Smith retired yesterday, Seth. Alex Smith retired.
The football player?
The football player, yes, the former quarterback for a handful of different NFL squads whose career was – not ended literally, but in terms of playing at a high level, was ended by J.J. Watt and Kareem Jackson on a gruesome sack back in 2018. Man, and Alex Smith accomplished a lot during his career. Coming back from that broken leg might be the thing that he's going to wind up being most remembered. I'm going to remember him for two things. Coming back from that broken leg and having literally the strangest career arc of any number one overall pick and maybe any quarterback that I can ever remember, Seth. He was a number one overall pick in 2005. A draft reminding you, a draft that Aaron Rodgers fell to 24th overall in. So Alex Smith first, and then Aaron Rodgers sat for 23 more picks. Alex Smith's first six seasons, he started 50 games and went 19-31. Then Jim Harbaugh showed up in 2011, and for the next 10 seasons, Alex Smith, for three different teams, started 117 games with a record of 86-1. He won over two-thirds of his games, Alex Smith did, over a 10-year period. He made the Pro Bowl three different times. Seth, you and I talked about this yesterday, about how teams have become very amenable to treating highly drafted quarterbacks as disposable a year, 2 years, 3 years into their career. The teams are willing to punt on highly drafted quarterbacks very early in their career. Alex Smith would have been one of those quarterbacks, undoubtedly. Back in the early part of his career, teams would not have given Alex Smith 6 years to get it in gear.
Well, yeah, and the crazy thing about Alex Smith, too, is that he was kind of at the forefront of college quarterbacks, athletic college quarterbacks,
yeah,
who could run a zone read style system. But there's a little bit of a lag between the NFL. Like, he left college, and the NFL hadn't quite caught up to running those systems yet in the NFL, and they started to. So, like, Alex Smith became almost an old guy that was benefiting by the new age of NFL football, and his athleticism helped him more. These days, the athleticism for a young quarterback helps immediately because they can run a lot of offense that gets them out of trouble, doesn't make them rely on their arm and what have you. Alex Smith, it was like he had to wait until the NFL caught up to his capabilities, and then he could start doing a lot of that stuff, especially with Andy Smith, or Andy Reid. So Alex Smith, the biggest thing I remember about him was the playoff exits they had where Alex Smith actually played pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, the NFC Championship game in San Francisco, there was a special teams fumble. That led to that loss.
That's
even
right.
Though they only scored 17 points. In Kansas City, same thing. They had some playoff exits where Alex Smith had actually played really, really well.
Yep.
And he could have made the Super Bowl a couple of times, and yet the rest of the team just didn't play up to it. Yeah, he was a hair's breadth away from being in conversations about, like, well, hey, is this guy overrated? Is it overrated? Sure, he won a couple of Super Bowls, but is he really that good?
Yeah.
Whereas now he'll perpetually be the guy that was just not quite good enough to not be supplanted by Patrick Mahomes or Colin Kaepernick.
Nice of his near-murderer J.J. Watt to acknowledge his career as well. J.J. Watt,
yes,
tweeted about him yesterday.
Tweeted, heck of a career pre-injury, legendary status post. And by that, I think JJ meant post-career,
right,
post-injury, he's legendary now. Absolutely incredible comeback, a picture of determination, perseverance, and sheer will. Thanks for the inspiration and best wishes on the next chapter. I'll say I always enjoy going through the comments to any J.J. Watt tweet because there's just so much snark afterwards. So many just angry little bastard haters that come out after him.
Right.
I was pleasantly surprised that I'd say only about 10% of the replies were noting that J.J. was the one that actually maimed Alex Smith.
Right, yeah. De facto ended his career.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.